This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We've seen a lot of deaths, and we're not prepared that we let the teachers to return back to the graves again.
That's Botswana's Teachers Association representative Tabokani Rari saying its members will not return to class until they are vaccinated. Details coming up. Also, Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed issues a call for eligible civilians to join the army to fight the forces from Tigray. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. Ambassador to Libya Richard Norland says General Khalifa Haftar, the head of the Libyan National Army, could have a significant influence in unifying the country's military institution. Norland, speaking with Al Jazeera TV, surprised some people by saying Haftar, one of the main forces behind Libya's civil war, is helping the political and military scene now. Jason Pack, president of Libya Analysis and the author of Libya and Global Enduring Disorder, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi the significance of the U.S. ambassador's statement.
Well, that is a very significant statement, Mohammed, and I was surprised when I heard it. I think the way to decode this is Libya has been in an impasse for many months now with no budget. And Ambassador Norland, as well as others, would like to urge various Libyan factions to get along, make compromises, and pass the budget. It seems that one of those compromises will involve paying 6 billion dinars to the Libyan National Army and Haftar for their participating in the budget and participating in the future of a unified military. So maybe the ambassador is signaling that he thinks that Haftar can participate in the security structures if appropriately coached and pushed.
But Faisal Gill, a lawyer representing victims' families in a lawsuit filed in Virginia courts against Haftar, comments on the ambassador's statement saying, before speaking of any role Haftar might play in the future of Libya, we believe he must face his victims in a court of law so he can be held accountable. Would that lawsuit constitute a hurdle in Haftar's quest for a major future role in Libya?
That's a very interesting question. Politically, the lawsuit does not affect what Haftar can do or not do on the ground. And its only implications is that if he's convicted, he cannot be easily invited to the United States for major diplomatic visits. Yes, it is a negative PR issue for him as it's going on, but it doesn't make it more difficult for him to work with Russia and the Emirates and other powers. So the lawsuit is kind of just a media relations problem for Haftar until such a point as he would have an official invite to the U.S., but he's not coming to the U.S. anytime soon.
Libyan Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah recognized earlier the difficulty of integrating his country's army despite reaching out to Khalifa Haftar, as the unity remains a challenge. On the other hand, Ian Cobbs, the UN Special Envoy for Libya, stated that Haftar militias in the east had refused to enable the government of national unity to take control of the region. What's the way out of this challenge?
I don't see a clear way out right now. When Dbeibah came into power, he didn't appoint a minister of defense because that's too polarizing. And of course, Kubis is right in saying that although government ministries have been unified, the security sector has not, and the LNA maintains its separate role in the East. That's going to stay that way for the foreseeable future. We just need to focus on getting over this budgetary hurdle. And if the budget can be used to buy off Haftar, then he can participate in larger unifying gestures. But that is still a few days away. So one thing at a time, and then after that, moving towards elections, but more important than anything, financial and structural reforms.
That was Jason Pack, president of Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. Roughly 6 weeks after the Ethiopian government declared a unilateral ceasefire in the Tigray region, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed issued a call today for all eligible civilians to join the armed forces to fight in the troubled region, according to the French news agency AFP. A statement from the Prime Minister's office says, now is the right time for all capable Ethiopians who are of age to join the defense forces, special forces, and militias, and to show patriotism. No response yet from Tigray officials. In Zambia, the ruling Patriotic Party predicts incumbent President Edgar Lungu will win Thursday's presidential election with at least 55% of the votes. Former Justice Minister Given Lubinda, who is the campaign chairman for Mr. Lungu's running mate, Nkandu Luo, says feedback from the party's campaign across the country is a strong indication of victory. But the main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND Alliance, says the government has not lived up to the aspirations of the people, arguing that in a fair election, the incumbent president is unlikely to defeat its presidential candidate, Hakainde Hichilema. It also says the administration is using state institutions, including the police, to frustrate the campaign of the UPND Alliance, accusations the ruling party denies. Political analysts are predicting a close contest between incumbent President Lungu and Hakainde Hichilema. Given Lubinda, campaign chairman for the ruling party's vice presidential candidate, spoke to VOA's Peter Cloutier about the party's confidence it will win the election.
The 2015 campaign was difficult, and yet President Edgar Lungu managed to win. The 2016 was the first one that was subjected to 50% plus one. Mm-hmm. And again, it was a very difficult race. From traversing the country, I can safely say this is going to be a much easier victory. Mm. For President Edgar Lungu, I don't see him getting less than 55%.
Well, what do you say to those who are predicting that it's too close to call and that it's UPND leader Hakainde Hichilema to lose, and that if push comes to shove, it will be difficult for the president to win re-election? Well, what do you tell such skeptics?
President Hakainde has gone around the country, and we've been watching what he has been doing. And the people of that opinion are the ones who have been swayed by the people that Hakainde has been bussing around for roadshows and bussing around for rallies and so on. And they have created that perception. In all the places we've gone to, we are yet to come across a small group of people that Hakainde met, where he met people and talked to them on a man-to-man basis. He has been trying to create some euphoria, and obviously some people are swayed by that. But truth be told, he hasn't reached the people that we have reached. We have reached individuals, we have reached people in their churches, we have reached people in their homes. And that makes a very big difference.
Mr. Lubinda, what do you say to supporters of the main opposition coalition saying that the leader, Hakainde Hichilema, is being tear-gassed, he's being prevented from campaigning, the police are stopping him everywhere, there is an uneven enforcement of the Public Order Act thwarting his campaign, and that if it is a fair election, President Edgar Chagwa Lungu will not win re-election? How do you respond to such criticism?
Now, that is rather preemptive, isn't it? How can one person say he's going to win and on the other hand say, I'm being blocked and this is the reason why I'm going to lose, this hasn't been free and fair? The same, you know, that's saying things tongue-in-cheek. The truth of the matter is that in Zambia we have laws that ought to be followed by all and sundry. You can't resign to your laws simply because there's an election. The cases where Hakainde has been stopped to hold public meetings, it's because he has gone ahead holding public meetings without notifying the police. And if that is against the law and the police stop him, you cannot say it's wrong. That is correct, because the police have a responsibility to implement and enforce the law to the letter. If the police are seen not to implement the law and there is a breakdown of law and order, they're the ones who are going to be held accountable. You don't expect the president of the Republic of Zambia, he's still president until such a time that he's sworn in and he hands power back to himself. He still is head of state and he's accountable to the Zambian people. If he hears that people are hacking each other to death, he certainly is expected to take action. And when he does take action, people cry foul and say he's being draconian. If he doesn't take action, lives are lost. And if the lives are lost during an election such as this period, what will happen? People will shun elections. They will not go and vote. And who will be held accountable? Again, it shall be he, because he's the only one who has executive power. So this is just a way of trying to preempt things and to try and create a caveat so that when the results are finally announced, he will fall back on it and say, well, actually, I warned everybody that the field was not even, the ground was not level.
That was Given Lubinda, campaign chairman for Zambia's ruling party vice presidential candidate, speaking with VOA's Peter Cloutier. Large parts of South Africa could be without electricity soon after the explosion at one of the country's biggest power stations. The incident deepens South Africa's power crisis, which has resulted in widespread blackouts in recent years and cost the economy billions of dollars. The situation has been blamed on mismanagement, corruption, and incompetence at National Electricity Regulator, Eskom. Darren Taylor has more.
Medupi in South Africa's northern Limpopo province has been under construction for 14 years, but is already the fourth largest coal-fired power station in the world. Eskom says the plant will be complete in about 2 years at an estimated cost of 135 billion rands. That's almost $10 billion. But Medupi's been plagued by construction delays and equipment failures. The latest crisis hit Sunday night. Energy expert and former Eskom manager Ted Blom explains that technicians had to repair a turbine and so needed to extract hydrogen gas from it by pumping in sulfur dioxide.
There's plenty of scope for error, and it indeed happened when they pumped in oxygen instead of sulfur dioxide. And it doesn't take much when you've got lots of hydrogen and oxygen to trigger an explosion.
Eskom says no one was injured in the blast, which caused extensive damage to a primary generator. Company spokesman Sikonati Manchancha says the workers and managers involved have been suspended, pending an investigation. Blom says many of Eskom's managers and technicians simply aren't skilled enough to maintain a complex installation.
And the problem with Eskom, of course, is that they've lost a lot of skills. They've exported skills to the whole world because of their quest to do racial balancing within the organization.
He says having more black managers and technicians at Eskom is ideal, but only if those people have the necessary skills. But over the years, says Blom, the company has employed the wrong people in the form of cadres loyal to the ruling African National Congress, with unsurprising results.
Firstly, their forensic and audit department hasn't picked up crime and corruption for more than 20 years. Their coal procurement has been substandard for 21 years, and in fact is getting worse. They have acknowledged that they're not on top of coal costs. They've messed up their coal supply model, which was mind-mouthed.
But much worse, says the analyst, is Eskom having poorly skilled technicians not up to the job of performing proper work, and thus putting the country's power supply and lives in jeopardy. He says the explosion at Medupi is clear evidence.
I'm afraid to say that I suspect that the same thing could repeat itself at all the hydrogen installations that Eskom has, and has one at probably every plant. It relates to the fact that there seems to be a systemic problem with the procedures that they are following.
Eskom says it'll comment further once the probe into the Medupi blast is finished. Blom says the Department of Labor is obliged to also investigate the explosion.
the Department of Labor better get its act together and make sure that it does the necessary security and safety checks on the procedures and protocols around the hydrogen plants in all the Eskom stations, not just at Medupi, all the stations, because they all run on similar technology. This is a much wider issue, and if Eskom doesn't and the Department of Labor don't step up, I can guarantee you the unions will.
He says the next blast could be far more devastating and could kill workers unless the authorities intervene urgently with the correct remedial steps. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Cameroonian officials say at least 82 former Boko Haram fighters from Nigeria and Chad, along with their families, have surrendered to authorities in the past week. Authorities say there's the latest among hundreds of the militant Islamists who have been defecting since May, when the group's leader was killed. Cameroon plans to deport the former fighters as the influx has overwhelmed rehabilitation centers along the border. Mokedwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's government on August 10 said its National Committee for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Center in Meri, a northern town on the border with Nigeria, has 967 former jihadist militants. A week ago, there were about 700 former Boko Haram fighters and their families in the center. Among the over 260 who arrived within the past 1 week are 82 former Boko Haram male fighters. The others are women and children. Francis Fayengo is the director of DDR centers created by the government of Cameroon for former fighters. He says over 200 of ex-militants are Nigerians. He spoke on Monday after President Paul Biya sent him to meet the former militants and to evaluate their needs.
We came to see the fighters, those young women and men, predominantly made of Nigerians, flooding out from the Boko Haram hands into our country. The numbers are increasing daily. We welcome them, but after we have done the necessary verifications, we send them back rapidly to their country because of the good relationships that our country has with our neighboring country to the west.
Yango said several of the former militants are Chadians. He said Biya has provided space and funds for a bigger DDR center to be constructed in Meme, another northern town not far from Nigeria. Yango said the center at Meri was too small to contain the increasing number of fleeing Boko Haram militants. The multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin that is fighting the jihadist group said the former militants handed themselves to troops around the Sambisa forest on the Cameroon-Nigeria border, an area considered as Boko Haram's stronghold. The task force is made up of troops from Niger, Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria. Nigeria has not issued a statement on the militants' defections. Cameroon says it has voluntarily handed former combatants to Nigeria several times, but that the number that surrendered this week is the highest. This month, Cameroon said since May, when Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau was declared dead, the jihadist group Boko Haram and its fighters are weaker and likely to surrender. Swaibu Issa is a researcher on Boko Haram at the University of Marwa. Issa says Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad should encourage fighters who are still reluctant to surrender and help to reconstruct their communities. He says rival jihadist groups are carrying out charitable acts around the Lake Chad Basin aimed at luring in Boko Haram militants and having fighters join other terrorist groups.
Le discours de l'Iswap tel qu'on l'a vu aux abords du Lac Tchad.
Issa says within the past 2 months, the Islamic State in West Africa province, or the Iswap, a splinter of Boko Haram, is increasingly gaining power and influence. He says Iswap has been highly active along the Cameroon-Nigeria-Chad border. He says while recognized international aid groups distribute food to populations in need, ISWAP also shares food to gain sympathy and recruit civilians. Speaking through the messaging platform WhatsApp from Marwa, Issa said it is possible that many militants want to surrender but fear reprisals from jihadist fighters. Kalbasu Daniel is the president of Cameroon's Far North Regional Council, or the CPDM party, created by the government to speed up local development. Kalbasu says it is imperative for the governments of Cameroon, Nigeria and Chad to provide jobs for the ex-jihadist militants. He says the former militants who surrender must be encouraged to have self-confidence that is needed before they can reintegrate work for development and become productive contributing members of society. Boko Haram terrorists have been fighting to establish an Islamic caliphate in Nigeria's northeast. The fighters began attacks inside Cameroon in 2014. According to the UN, 30,000 people have been killed and 1.8 million displaced in Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad since 2009, when the fighting deteriorated into an armed conflict with Nigerian government troops. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Botswana teachers say they will not return to the classroom if they are not vaccinated. Schools are scheduled to reopen Monday after a spike in COVID-19 cases forced a month's break. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
President Mokgweetsi Masisi closed schools last month as the Southern African country saw an unprecedented spike in coronavirus cases. Botswana is one of the highest COVID-19 rates per capita in the world, and the virus has claimed the lives of more than 100 teachers since May. Botswana Teachers Union representative Tabokani Rari says its members will not return to class until they are vaccinated.
I think enough is enough. We have seen more deaths. We've seen a lot of deaths, and we're not prepared that we let the teachers to return back to the graves again. So that is the stand that we have taken. If pushes comes to shove, then we'll be left with no option but also to interdict the government from continuing to reopen the schools.
In June, Masisi promised to move teachers to the front of the vaccination queue.
We will not hesitate to provide you with the necessary support for you to perform your duties under a safe environment. My government will roll out a successful and timely vaccination program to curb the impact of the disease on our people, including yourselves, teachers. I am pleased to confirm that teachers and other frontliners will be vaccinated as a priority.
The government blames delays in vaccine arrivals for failure to carry out that commitment and says it hopes the program is back on track. Education sector unions have called for a shutdown meeting with the Minister of Education on Thursday. They say they are prepared to go to court to force a delay in reopening schools. On Sunday, Botswana received 38,400 doses of AstraZeneca vaccines, with 108,000 expected to arrive from Johnson & Johnson Thursday. Around 5% of the country's population is fully vaccinated, while 1,704 people have died from the 122,574 confirmed COVID-19 cases. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
Wildfires fanned by blistering temperatures have killed at least 7 people in a mountainous area east of the Algerian capital, Algiers. However, the French news agency AFP, quoting Interior Minister Kamal Beljoud, says the fires have criminal origins and 3 suspected arsonists have been arrested. Arson has been blamed for several major fires in Algeria in recent years. Last year alone, nearly 440 square kilometers of forest were destroyed by fire, and several people were arrested on suspicion of arson. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.